Raphael shrugged. You can either tell me what you wanted to tell me, or I will leave. It's up to you. He looked at his watch. You have 30 seconds. I told my mother I'm a vampire. Raphael's eyebrows went up. They were very thin and very dark. In less generous moments, Simon sometimes wondered if he penciled them on. And what happened? She called me a monster and tried to prey at me. The memory made bitter taste of old blood rise in the back of Simon's throat. And then? And then I'm not sure what happened. I started talking to her in this really weird, soothing voice, telling her nothing had happened and it was all a dream. And she believed you? She believed me, Simon said reluctantly. Of course she did, said Raphael. Because you are a vampire. It is a power we have. The encanto. The fascination. The power of persuasion, you would call it. You can convince mundane humans of almost anything if you learn how to use the ability properly. But I didn't want to use it on her. She's my mother. Is there some way to take it off her? Some way to fix it? Fix it? So she hates you again? So she thinks you are a monster? That is a very odd definition of fixing something. I don't care, said Simon. Is there a way? No, Raphael said cheerfully. There is not. You would know all of this, of course, if you did not disdain your own kind so much. That's right. Act like I rejected you. It's not like you tried to kill me or anything. Raphael shrugged. That was politics, not personal. He leaned back against the railing and crossed his arms over his chest. He was wearing black motorcycle gloves. Simon had to admit, he looked pretty cool. Please tell me you did not bring me out here so you could tell me a very boring story about your sister. My mother, Simon corrected. Raphael flipped a dismissive hand. Whatever. Some female in your life has rejected you. It will not be the last time, I can tell you that. Why are you bothering me about it? I wanted to know if I could come and stay at the Dumont, Simon said, getting the words out very fast so that he couldn't back out halfway. He could barely believe he was asking. His memories of the Vampire Hotel were memories of blood and terror and pain. But it was a place to go, a place to stay where no one would look for him, and so he would not have to go home. He was a vampire. It was stupid to be afraid of a hotel full of other vampires. I haven't got anywhere else to go. Raphael's eyes glittered. Aha, he said, with a soft triumph Simon did not particularly like. Now you want something from me. I suppose so. Although it's creepy that you're so excited about that, Raphael. Raphael snorted. If you come to stay at the Dumont, you will not address me as Raphael, but as master, sire, or great leader. Simon braced himself. What about Camille? Raphael started. What do you mean? You always told me you weren't really the head of the vampires, Simon said blandly. Then in Idris, you told me it was someone named Camille. You said she hadn't come back to New York yet, but I assume when she does, she'll be the master or whatever. Raphael's gaze darkened. I do not like your line of questioning, Daylighter. I have a right to know these things. No, said Raphael. You don't. You come to me, asking if you can stay in my hotel because you have nowhere else to go. Not because you wish to be with others of your own kind. You shun us. Which, as I already pointed out, has to do with that time you tried to kill me. The Dumont is not a halfway house for reluctant vampires, Raphael went on. You live among humans. You walk in the daylight. You play in your stupid band. Yes. Don't think I don't know about that. In every way, you do not accept what you really are. And as long as that is true, you are not welcome at the Dumont. Simon thought of Camille saying, the moment his followers see that you are with me, they will leave him and come to me. I believe they are loyal to me beneath the fear of him. Once they see us together, that fear will be gone, and they will come to our side. You know, he said, I've had other offers. Raphael looked at him as if he were insane. Offers of what? Just offers, Simon said feebly. You are terrible at this politics business, Simon Lewis. I suggest you do not attempt it again. Fine, Simon said. I came here to tell you something, but now I'm not going to. I suppose you are going to throw away the birthday present you got me, Raphael said. It is all very tragic. He retrieved his motorcycle and swung a leg over it as the engine revved to life. Red sparks flew from the exhaust pipe. If you bother me again, De Leiter, it had better be for a good reason, or I will not be forgiving. And with that, the motorcycle surged forward and upward. Simon craned his head back to watch as Raphael, like the angel he was named for, soared into the sky, trailing fire.
Clary sat with her sketch pad on her knees and gnawed the end of her pencil thoughtfully. She had drawn Jace dozens of times. She guessed it was her version of most girls writing about their boyfriends in their diaries, but she never seemed to be able to get him exactly right. For one thing, it was almost impossible to get him to stand still, so she thought that now, while he was asleep, would be perfect. But it still wasn't coming out quite the way she wanted. It just didn't look like him. She tossed the sketch pad onto the blanket with a sigh of exasperation and pulled her knees up, looking down at him. She hadn't expected him to fall asleep. They'd come to Central Park to eat lunch and train outside while the weather was still good. They'd done one of those things. Takeout containers from Takis were scattered in the grass beside the blanket. Jace hadn't eaten much, picking through his carton of sesame noodles in a desultory fashion before tossing it aside and flinging himself down onto the blanket, staring up at the sky. Clary had sat, looking down at him, at the way the clouds reflected in his clear eyes, the outline of muscles in the arms crossed behind his head, the perfect strip of skin revealed between the hem of his t-shirt and the belt of his jeans. She had wanted to reach out and slide her hand along his hard, flat stomach. Instead, she diverted her eyes, rummaging for her sketch pad. When she turned back, pencil in hand, his eyes were closed and his breathing was soft and even. She was now three drafts into her illustration and no closer to a drawing that satisfied her. Looking at him now, she wondered why on earth she couldn't draw him. The light was perfect, soft bronze October light that laid a sheen of paler gold over his already golden hair and skin. His closed lids were fringed with gold, a shade darker than his hair. One of his hands were draped loosely over his chest, the other open at his side. His face was relaxed and vulnerable in sleep, softer and less angular than when he was awake. Perhaps that was the problem. He was so rarely relaxed and vulnerable, it was hard to capture the lines of him when he was. It felt unfamiliar. At that precise moment, he moved. He had begun making little gasping sounds in his sleep, his eyes darting back and forth behind his shut eyelids. His hand jerked, tightened against his chest, and he sat up, so suddenly that he nearly knocked Clary over. His eyes flew open. For a moment he looked simply dazed. He had gone startlingly pale. Jace? Clary couldn't hide her surprise. His eyes focused on her. A moment later, he had drawn her toward him with none of his customary gentleness. He pulled her onto his lap and kissed her fiercely, his hands winding into her hair. She could feel the hammering of his heart with hers, and she felt her cheeks flush. They were in a public park, she thought, and people were probably staring. Whoa, he said, drawing back, his lips curving into a smile. Sorry, you probably weren't expecting that. It was a nice surprise. Her voice sounded low and throaty to her own ears. What were you dreaming about? You? He twisted a lock of her hair around his finger. I always dream about you. Still on his lap, her legs straddling his, Clary said, Oh yeah? Because I thought you were having a nightmare. He tipped his head back to look at her. Sometimes I dream you're gone, he said. I keep wondering when you'll figure out how much better you could do and leave me. She touched his face with her fingertips, delicately running them over the planes of his cheekbones, down to the curve of his mouth. Jace never said things like that to anyone else but her. Alec and Isabel knew, from living with him and loving him, that underneath the protective armor of humor and pretended arrogance, the ragged shards of memory and childhood still tore at him. But she was the only one he said the words out loud to. She shook her head. Her hair fell forward across her forehead, and she pushed it away impatiently. "I wish I could say things the way you do," she said. "Everything you say, the words you choose, they're so perfect. You always find the right quote or the right thing to say to make me believe you love me. If I can't convince you that I'll never leave you," he caught her hand in his. "Just say it again." "I'll never leave you," she said. "No matter what happens, what I do. I'd never give up on you," she said. "Never. What I feel about you," she stumbled over the words. "It's the most important thing I've ever felt." Damn it, she thought. That sounded completely stupid. But Jace didn't seem to think so. He smiled wistfully and said, "L'amour che muove il sole e l'altre stelle." "Is that Latin?" "Italian," he said. "Dante." She ran her fingertips over his lips, and he shivered. "I don't speak Italian," she said, very softly. "It means," he said, "that love is the most powerful force in the world, that love can do anything." She drew her hand out of his, aware as she did that he was watching her through half-lidded eyes. She locked both hands around the back of his neck, leaned forward, and touched his lips with hers. Not a kiss this time, just a brush of lips against each other. It was enough. She felt his pulse speed up, and he leaned forward, trying to capture her mouth with his. But she shook her head, shaking her hair around them like a curtain that would hide them from the eyes of everyone else in the park. "If you're tired, we could go back to the Institute," she said in a half-whisper. "Take a nap." "We haven't slept together in the same bed since Idris." Their gazes locked, and she knew he was remembering the same thing she was. The pale light filtering in through the window of Amatis's small spare bedroom, the desperation in his voice. "I just want to lie down with you and wake up with you. Just once. Just once ever in my life." That whole night, lying side by side, only their hands touching. They had touched much more since that night, but had never spent the night together. He knew she was offering him more than a nap in one of the Institute's unused bedrooms, too. She was sure he could see it in her eyes, even if she herself wasn't exactly sure how much she was offering. But it didn't matter. Jace would never ask her for anything she didn't want to give. "I want to." The heat she saw in his eyes, the ragged edge to his voice, told her he wasn't lying. "But we can't." He took her wrists firmly and drew them down, holding their hands between them, making a barrier. Clary's eyes widened. "Why not?" He took a deep breath. "We came here to train, and we should train. If we just spend all the time we're supposed to be training making out instead, they'll quit letting me help you train at all." "Aren't they supposed to be hiring someone else to train me full-time anyway?" "Yes," he said, getting up and pulling her to her feet along with him. "And I'm worried that if you get into the habit of making out with your instructors, you'll wind up making out with him too." "Don't be sexist. They could find me a female instructor." "In that case, you have my permission to make out with her as long as I can watch." "Nice," Clary grinned, bending down to fold up the blanket they'd brought to sit on. "You're just worried they'll hire a male instructor and he'll be hotter than you." Jace's eyebrows went up. "Hotter than me?" "It could happen," Clary said. "You know, theoretically." Theoretically, the planet could suddenly crack in half, leaving me on one side and you on the other side, forever and tragically parted. But I'm not worried about that either. Some things, Jay said with his customary crooked smile, are just too unlikely to dwell upon. He held out his hand. She took it. And together they crossed the meadow, heading for a copse of trees at the edge of the East Meadow that only Shadowhunters seemed to know about. Clary suspected it was glamored, since she and Jace trained there fairly often, and no one had ever interrupted them there except for Isabel and Maris. Central Park in autumn was a riot of color. The trees lining the meadow had put on their brightest colors and circled the green in blazing gold, red, copper, and russet orange. It was a beautiful day to take a romantic walk through the park and kiss on one of the stone bridges. But that wasn't going to happen. Obviously, as far as Chase was concerned, the park was an outside extension of the Institute's training room, and they were there to run Clary through various exercises involving terrain navigation, escape and evasion techniques, and killing things with her bare hands. Normally, she would have been excited to learn how to kill things with her bare hands, but there was still something bothering her about Jace. She couldn't rid herself of the nagging feeling that something was seriously wrong. If only there were a rune, she thought, that would make him tell her what he was really feeling. But she would never create a rune like that, she reminded herself hastily. It would be unethical to use her power to try to control someone else. And besides, since she'd created the binding rune in Idris, her power had lain seemingly dormant. She had felt no urge to draw old runes, nor had she had any visions of new runes to create. Maris had told her that they would be trying to bring in a specialist in runes to tutor her, once training really got underway. But so far, that hadn't materialized. Not that she minded, really. She had to admit, she wasn't sure she would be entirely sorry if her power had vanished forever. There are going to be times when you encounter a demon and you don't have a fighting weapon, Jace was saying as they passed under a row of trees laden with low-hanging leaves whose colors ran the gamut from green to brilliant gold. At that point, you can't panic. First, you have to remember that anything can be a weapon, a tree branch, a handful of coins. They make great brass knuckles. A shoe, anything. And second, keep in mind that you are a weapon. In theory, when you're done with training, you should be able to kick a hole in a wall, or knock out a moose with a single punch. I would never hit a moose, said Clary. They're endangered. Jace smiled slightly and swung to face her. They had reached the copse, a small cleared area in the center of a stand of trees. There were runes carved into the trunks of the trees that surrounded them, marking it as a Shadowhunter place. There's an ancient fighting style called Muay Thai, he said. Have you heard of it? She shook her head. The sun was bright and steady, and she was almost too hot in her track pants and warm-up jacket. Jace took off his jacket and turned back to her, flexing his slim pianist's hands. His eyes were intensely gold in the autumn light. Marks for speed, agility, and strength trailed like a pattern of vines from his wrists up and over the swell of each bicep, disappearing under the sleeves of his t-shirt. She wondered why he'd bothered marking himself up as if she were a foe to be reckoned with. I heard a rumor that the new instructor we're getting next week is a master of Muay Thai, he said, and Sambo, Tomoy, Krav Maga, Jiu-Jitsu, and another one that, frankly, I don't remember the name of, but it involves killing people with small sticks or something. My point is, he or she isn't going to be used to working with someone your age who's as inexperienced as you are. So if we teach you a few of the basics, I'm hoping it'll make them feel a little more generously toward you. He reached out to put his hands on her hips. Now, turn and face me. Clary did as instructed. Facing each other like this, her head came to the bottom of his chin. She rested her hands lightly on his biceps. Muay Thai is called the art of eight limbs. That's because you use not just your fists and feet as strike points, but also your knees and elbows. First, you want to pull your opponent in, then pummel him with every one of your strike points until he or she collapses. And that works on demons? Clary raised her eyebrows. The smaller ones. Jace moved closer to her. Okay, reach your hand around and grip the back of my neck. It was just possible to do as he instructed without going up on her toes. Not for the first time, Clary cursed the fact that she was so short. Now, you raise your other hand and do the same thing again, so your hands are looped around the back of my neck. She did it. The back of his neck was warm from the sun, and his soft hair tickled her fingers. Their bodies were pressed up against each other. She could feel the ring she wore on a chain around her neck pressed between them like a pebble pressed between two palms. In a real fight, you'd do that move much faster, he said. Unless she was imagining it, his voice was a little unsteady. Now if that grip on me gives you leverage, you're going to use that leverage to pull yourself forward and add momentum to your upward knee kicks. My, my, said a cool, amused voice. Only 6 weeks and already at each other's throats. How swiftly mortal love does fade. Releasing her hold on Jace, Clary whirled, though she already knew who it was. The queen of the Seedley Court stood in the shadows between two trees. If Clary had not known she was there, she wondered if she would have seen her, even with the sight. The queen wore a gown as green as grass, and her hair falling around her shoulders was the color of a turning leaf. She was as beautiful and awful as a dying season. Clary had never trusted her. What are you doing here? It was Jace, his eyes narrow. This is a Shadowhunter place. And I have news of interest to Shadowhunters. As the queen stepped gracefully forward, the sun lanced down through the trees and sparked off the circlet of golden berries she wore around her head. Clary sometimes wondered if the queen planned these dramatic entrances, and if so, how? There has been another death. What sort of death? Another one of you, dead Nephilim. There was a certain relish to the way the queen said it. The body was found this dawn beneath Oak Bridge. As you know, the park is my domain. A human killing is not of concern to me, but the death did not seem to be one of mundane origins. The body was brought to the court to be examined by my physicians. They pronounced the dead mortal one of yours. Clary looked quickly at Jace, remembering the news of the dead Shadowhunter 2 days before. She could tell Jace was thinking the same thing. He had paled. "Where's the body?" he asked. "Are you concerned about my hospitality? He bides in my court, and I assure you that we afford his body all the respect we would give a living Shadowhunter. Now that one of my own has a place on the council beside you and yours, you can hardly doubt our good faith." As always, good faith and my lady go hand in hand. The sarcasm in Jace's voice was clear, but the queen just smiled. She liked Jace. Clary had always thought, in that way that fairies liked pretty things because they were pretty. She did not think the queen liked her, and the feeling was mutual. "And why are you giving this message to us instead of to Maris? Custom would indicate..." "Oh, custom," the queen waved away convention with a flip of her hand. "You were here. It seemed expedient." Jace gave her another narrow look and flipped his cell phone open. He gestured at Clary to stay where she was and walked a little ways away. She could hear him saying, "Maris?" as the phone was answered, and then his voice was swallowed up by shouts from the playing fields nearby. With a feeling of cold dread, she looked back at the queen. She had not seen the Lady of the Seelie Court since her last night in Idris. And then Clary had not exactly been polite to her. She doubted the queen had forgotten, or forgiven her, for that. Would you truly refuse a favor from the Queen of the Seelie Court? I heard Meliorn got a seat on the council, Clary said now. You must be pleased about that. Indeed, the Queen looked at her with amusement. I am sufficiently delighted. So, Clary said, no hard feelings then? The Queen's smile turned icy around the edges, like frost rimming the sides of a pond. I suppose you refer to my offer, which you so rudely declined, she said. As you know, my objective was accomplished regardless. The loss there, I imagine most would agree, was yours. I didn't want your deal. Clary tried to keep the sharpness from her voice and failed. People can't do what you want all the time, you know. Do not presume to lecture me, child. The Queen's eyes followed Jace, who was pacing at the edge of the trees, phone in hand. He is beautiful, she said. I can see why you love him. But did you ever wonder what draws him to you? Clary said nothing to that. There seemed nothing to say. The blood of heaven binds you, said the Queen. Blood calls to blood, under the skin. But love and blood are not the same. Riddles, Clary said angrily. Do you even mean anything when you talk like that? He is bound to you, said the Queen. But does he love you? Clary felt her hands twitch. She longed to try out on the Queen some of the new fighting moves she'd learned, but she knew how unwise that would be. Yes, he does. And does he want you? For love and desire are not always as one. That's none of your business, Clary said shortly. But she could see that the Queen's eyes on her were as sharp as pins. You want him like you have never wanted anything else. But does he feel the same? The Queen's soft voice was inexorable. He could have anything or anyone he pleases. Do you wonder why he chose you? Do you wonder if he regrets it? Has he changed toward you? Clary felt tears sting the backs of her eyes. No, he hasn't. But she thought of his face in the elevator that night, and the way he had told her to go home when she'd offered to stay. You told me that you did not wish to make a compact with me, for there was nothing I could give you. You said there was nothing in the world you wanted. The Queen's eyes glittered. When you imagine your life without him, do you still feel the same? Why are you doing this to me? Clary wanted to scream, but she said nothing, for the Fairy Queen glanced past her and smiled, saying, Wipe your tears, for he returns. It will do you no good for him to see you cry. Clary rubbed hastily at her eyes with the back of her hand and turned. Jace was walking toward them, frowning. Maris is on her way to the court, he said. Where did the Queen go? Clary looked at him, surprised. She's right here, she began, turning, and broke off. Jace was right. The Queen was gone. Only a swirl of leaves at Clary's feet to show where she had stood.
Simon, his jacket wadded up under his head, was lying on his back, staring up at the hole-filled ceiling of Eric's garage with a sense of grim fatality. His duffel bag was at his feet, his phone pressed against his ear. Right now, the familiarity of Clary's voice in the other end of it was the only thing keeping him from falling apart completely. Simon, I'm so sorry. He could tell she was somewhere in the city. The loud blare of traffic sounded behind her, muffling her voice. Are you seriously in Eric's garage? Does he know you're there? No, Simon said. No one's home at the moment, and I've got the garage key. It seemed like the place to go. Where are you, anyway? In the city. To Brooklynites, Manhattan was always the city. No other metropolis existed. I was training with Jace, but then he had to go back to the Institute for some kind of Clave business. I'm headed back to Luke's now. A car honked loudly in the background. Look, do you want to stay with us? You could sleep on Luke's couch. Simon hesitated. He had good memories of Luke's. In all the years he'd known Clary, Luke had lived in the same ratty but pleasant old row house over the bookstore. Clary had a key, and she and Simon had whiled away a lot of pleasant hours there, reading books they'd borrowed from the store downstairs or watching old movies on the TV. Things were different now, though. Maybe my mom could talk to your mom, Clary said, sounding worried by his silence. Make her understand. Make her understand that I'm a vampire? Clary, I think she does understand that, in a weird kind of way. That doesn't mean she's going to accept it or ever be okay with it. Well, you can't just keep making her forget, either, Simon, Clary said. It's not going to work forever. Why not? He knew he was being unreasonable. But lying on the hard floor, surrounded by the smell of gasoline and the whisper of spiders spinning their webs in the corners of the garage, feeling lonelier than he ever had, reasonable seemed very far away. Because then your whole relationship with her is a lie. You can't never go home. So what? Simon interrupted harshly. That's part of the curse, isn't it? A fugitive and a wanderer shalt thou be? Despite the traffic noises and the sound of chatter in the background, he could hear Clary's sudden indrawn breath. You think I should tell her about that too? He said. How you put the mark of Cain on me? How I'm basically a walking curse? You think she's going to want that in her house? The background sounds quieted. Clary must have ducked into a doorway. He could hear her struggling to hold back tears as she said, Simon, I'm sorry. You know I'm sorry. It's not your fault. He suddenly felt bone tired. That's right, terrify your mother and then make your best friend cry. A banner day for you, Simon. Look, obviously I shouldn't be around people right now. I'm just going to stay here, and I'll crash with Eric when he gets home. She made a snuffling, laughing through tears sound. What, doesn't Eric count as people? I'll get back to you on that later, he said, and hesitated. I'll call you tomorrow, all right? You'll see me tomorrow. You promised to come to that dress fitting with me, remember? Whoa, he said. I must really love you. I know, she said. I love you too. Simon clicked off the phone and lay back, holding it against his chest. It was funny, he thought. Now he could say, I love you, to Clary, when for years he'd struggled to say those words and had not been able to get them out of his mouth. Now that he no longer meant them the same way, it was easy. Sometimes he did wonder what would have happened if there had never been a Jace Wayland. If Clary had never found out she was a shadow hunter. But he pushed that thought away. Pointless. Don't go down that road. You couldn't change the past, you could only go forward. Not that he had any idea of what forward entailed. He couldn't stay in Eric's garage forever. Even in his current mood, he had to admit it was a miserable place to stay. He wasn't cold, he no longer felt cold or heat in any real way, but the floor was hard, and he was having trouble sleeping. He wished he could dull his senses. The loud noise of traffic outside was keeping him from resting, as was the unpleasant stench of gasoline. But it was a gnawing worry about what to do next that was the worst. He'd thrown away most of his blood supply and stashed the rest in his knapsack. He had about enough for a few more days, and then he'd be in trouble. Eric, wherever he was certainly let Simon stay in the house if he wanted, but that might result in Eric's parents calling Simon's mom. And since she thought he was on a school field trip, that would do him no good at all. Days, he thought. That was the amount of time he had. Before he ran out of blood, before his mother started to wonder where he was and called the school looking for him, before she started to remember, he was a vampire now. He was supposed to have eternity. But what he had was days. He had been so careful, tried so hard for what he thought of as a normal life. School, friends, his own house, his own bedroom. It had been strained, but it was what life was. Other options seemed so bleak and lonely that they didn't bear thinking about. and yet Camille's voice rang in his head. What about in 10 years, when you were supposed to be 26? In 20 years, 30, do you think no one will notice that, as they age and change, you do not? The situation he had created for himself, had carved so carefully in the shape of his old life, had never been permanent, he thought now, with a sinking in his chest. It never could have been. He'd been clinging to shadows and memories. He thought again of Camille, of her offer. It sounded better now than it had before. An offer of community, even if it wasn't the community he wanted. He had only about 3 more days before she'd come looking for his answer. And what would he tell her when she did? He thought he'd knew, but now he wasn't so sure. A grinding noise interrupted his reverie. The garage door was ratcheting upward, bright lights spearing into the dark interior of the space. Simon sat up, his whole body suddenly on the alert.
Eric?
No, it's me, Kyle.
Kyle?
Simon said blankly, before he remembered. The guy that agreed to take on as lead singer. Simon almost flopped back down onto the ground again.
Oh, right. None of the other guys are here right now, so if you were hoping to practice...
It's cool. That's not why I came. Kyle stepped into the garage, blinking in the darkness, his hands in the back pockets of his jeans.
You're our... what's his name? The bassist, right?
Simon got to his feet, brushing garage floor dust off his clothes.
I'm Simon.
Kyle glanced around, a perplexed furrow between his brows.
I left my keys here yesterday, I think. Been looking for them everywhere. Oh, there they are.
He ducked behind the drum set and emerged a second later, rattling a set of keys triumphantly in his hand. He looked much the same as he had the day before. He had a blue t-shirt on today, under a leather jacket, and a gold Saints medal sparkled around his neck. His dark hair was messier than ever.
So,
Kyle said, leaning against one of the speakers.
Were you, like, sleeping here, on the floor?
Simon nodded.
Got thrown out of my house.
It wasn't precisely true, but it was all he felt like saying. Kyle nodded sympathetically.
Mom found your weed stash, huh? That sucks.
No.
No weed stash.
Simon shrugged.
We had a difference of opinion about my lifestyle. So she found out about your 2 girlfriends.
Carl grinned. He was good looking, and Simon had to admit, but unlike Jace, who seemed to know exactly how good looking he was, Carl seemed like someone who probably hadn't brushed his hair in weeks. There was an open, friendly puppyishness about him that was appealing, though.
Yeah, Kirk told me about it. Good for you, man.
Simon shook his head.
It wasn't that.
There was a short silence between them, then.
I don't live at home either, Carl said. I left a couple years ago.
He hugged his arms around himself, hanging his head down. His voice was low.
I haven't talked to my parents since then. I mean, I'm doing all right on my own, but I get it.
Your tattoos, Simon said, touching his own arms lightly. What do they mean? Carl stretched his arms out.
Shanti, 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 he said. They're mantras from the Upanishads, Sanskrit. Prayers for peace.
Normally Simon would have thought that getting yourself tattooed in Sanskrit was kind of pretentious. But right now he didn't.
Shalom, he said.
Kyle blinked at him.
What? It means peace, said Simon. In Hebrew. I was just thinking the words sounded sort of alike.
Kyle gave him a long look. He seemed to be deliberating. Finally he said,
this is going to sound sort of crazy. Oh, I don't know. My definition of crazy has become pretty flexible in the past few months. But I have an apartment in Alphabet City, and my roommate just moved out. It's a 2-bedroom, so you could crash in his space. There's a bed in there and everything.
Simon hesitated. On the one hand, he didn't know Kyle at all, and moving into the apartment of a total stranger seemed like a stupid move of epic proportions. Kyle could turn out to be a serial killer despite his peace tattoos. On the other hand, he didn't know Kyle at all, which meant no one would come looking for him there. And what did it matter
if Kyle did turn out to be a serial killer, he thought bitterly. It would turn out worse for Kyle than it would for him, just like it had for the mugger last night. You know, he said, I think I'll take you up on that, if it's okay. Kyle nodded. My truck's just outside if you want to ride into the city with me. Simon bent to grab his duffel bag and straightened with it slung over his shoulder. He slid his phone into his pocket and spread his hands wide, indicating his readiness. Let's go. Chapter 5. Hell Calls Hell. Kyle's apartment turned out to be a pleasant surprise. Simon expected a filthy walk-up in an Avenue D tenement with roaches crawling on the walls and a bed made out of mattress foam and milk crates. In reality, it was a clean two-bedroom with a small living area, a ton of bookshelves, and lots of photos on the walls of famous surfing spots. Admittedly, Kyle seemed to be growing marijuana plants on the fire escape, but you couldn't have everything. Simon's room was basically an empty box. Whoever had lived there before had left nothing behind but a futon mattress. It had bare walls, bare floors, and a single window through which Simon could see the neon sign of the Chinese restaurant across the street. You like it? Kyle inquired, hovering in the doorway, his hazel eyes open and friendly. It's great, Simon replied honestly. Exactly what I needed. The most expensive item in the apartment was the flat-screen TV in the living room. They threw themselves down on the futon couch and watched bad TV as the sunlight dimmed outside. Kyle was cool, Simon decided. He didn't poke, didn't pry, didn't ask questions. He didn't seem to want anything in exchange for the room except for Simon to pitch in grocery money. He was just a friendly guy. Simon wondered if he'd forgotten what ordinary human beings were like. After Kyle headed out to work an evening shift, Simon went into his room, collapsed on the mattress, and listened to the traffic going by on Avenue B. He had been haunted by thoughts of his mother's face since he'd left, the way she looked at him with loathing and fear, as if he were an intruder in her house. Even if he didn't need to breathe, the thought of it still constricted his chest. But now, when he was a kid, he'd always liked traveling, because being in a new place meant being away from all his problems. Even here, just a river away from Brooklyn, the memories that had been eating at him like acid, the mugger's death, his mother's reaction to the truth of what he was, seemed blurred and distant. Maybe that was the secret, he thought. Keep moving, like a shark. Go to where no one could find you. A fugitive and a wanderer shall thou be in the earth. But that only worked if there was no one you cared about leaving behind. He slept fitfully all night. His natural urge was to sleep during the day, despite his daylight powers, and he fought off the restlessness and dreams before waking up late with the sun streaming in through the window. After throwing on clean clothes from his knapsack, he left the bedroom to find Kyle in the kitchen, frying bacon and eggs in a Teflon pan.
Hey, roommate, Kyle greeted him cheerfully. Want some breakfast?
The sight of food made Simon feel vaguely sick to his stomach.
No, thanks. I'll take some coffee, though.
He perched himself on one of the slightly lopsided bar stools. Kyle pushed the chipped mug across the counter toward him.
Breakfast is the most important meal of the day, bro, even if it's already noon.
Simon put his hands around the mug, feeling the heat seep into his cold skin. He cast about for the topic of conversation, one that wasn't how little he ate.
So I never asked you yesterday, what do you do for a living?
Kyle picked a piece of bacon out of the pan and bit into it. Simon noticed that the gold medal at his throat had a pattern of leaves on it, and the words, Beati Bellicosi. Beati, Simon knew, was a word that has something to do with saints. Kyle must be Catholic.
Bike messenger, he said, chewing. It's awesome. I get to ride around the city, seeing everything, talking to everyone. Way better than high school.
You dropped out?
Got my GED senior year. I prefer the school of life.
Simon would have thought Kyle sounded ridiculous if it weren't for the fact he said,
school of life,
the way he said everything else, with total sincerity.
What about you? Any plans?
Oh, you know, wander the earth, causing death and destruction to innocent people, maybe drink some blood, live forever, but never have any fun, the usual, he thought.
I'm kind of winging it at the moment. You mean you don't want to be a musician? Kyle asked.
To Simon's relief, his phone rang before he had to answer that. He fished it out of his pocket and looked at the screen. It was Maya.
Hey, he greeted her. What's up?
Are you going to be at that dress fitting with Clary this afternoon? She asked,
a voice crackling down the line. She was probably calling from PAC headquarters in Chinatown where the reception wasn't great.
She told me she was making you go to keep her company.
What? Oh, right. Yeah, I'll be there.
Clary had demanded that Simon accompany her to her bridesmaid's dress fitting so afterward they could shop for comics and she could feel, in her words, like, less of a frilled up girly girl.
Well, I'm going to come to them. I have to give Luke a message from the pack, and besides, I feel like I haven't seen you in ages.
I know. I'm really sorry.
It's fine, she said lightly.
But you're going to have to let me know what you're wearing to the wedding eventually, because otherwise we'll clash.
She hung up, leaving Simon staring at the phone. Clary had been right. The wedding was D-Day, and he was woefully unprepared for the battle.
One of your girlfriends?
Kyle asked curiously.
Was that red-headed chick at the garage one of them? Because she was cute. No, that was Clary. She's my best friend.
Simon pocketed his phone.
And she has a boyfriend. Like, really, really, really has a boyfriend. The nuclear bomb of boyfriends, trust me on this one.
Kyle grinned.
I was just asking.
He dumped the bacon pan, now empty, into the sink.
So, your two girls, what are they like?
They're very, very different.
In some ways, Simon thought they were opposites. Maya was calm and grounded. Isabel lived at a high pitch of excitement. Maya was a steady light in the darkness. Isabel a burning star, spinning through the void.
I mean, they're both great, beautiful and smart. And they don't know about each other?
Kyle leaned against the counter.
Like at all?
Simon found himself explaining how when he'd come back from Idris, though he didn't mention the place by name, they both started calling him, wanting to hang out. And because he liked them both, he went. And somehow, it had snowballed. And here he was, not wanting to hurt either of them, and not knowing how to go on either.
Well, if you ask me,
Kyle said, turning to dump his remaining coffee out in the sink,
you ought to pick one of them and quit dogging around, I'm just saying.
Since his back was to Simon, Simon couldn't see his face, and for a moment he wondered if Kyle was actually angry. His voice sounded uncharacteristically stiff, but when Kyle turned around, his expression was as open and as friendly as ever. Simon decided he must have imagined it.
I know, he said. You're right.
He glanced back toward the bedroom.
Look, are you sure it's okay, me staying here? I can clear out whenever. It's fine. You stay here as long as you need.
Kyle opened a kitchen drawer and scrabbled around until he found what he was looking for. A set of spare keys on a rubber band ring.
There's a set for you. You're totally welcome here, okay? I gotta go to work, but you can hang around if you want, play Halo or whatever. Will you be here when I get back?
Simon shrugged.
Probably not. I have a dress fitting to get to at 3.
Cool, said Kyle, slinging a messenger bag over his shoulder and heading toward the door.
Get him to make something in red. It's totally your color.
So, Clary said, stepping out of the dressing room, what do you think? She did an experimental twirl. Simon balanced on one of Karen's bridal shop's uncomfortable white chairs, shifted position, winced, and said,
you look nice.
She looked better than nice. Clary was her mother's only bridesmaid, so she'd been allowed to pick out whatever dress she wanted. She'd selected a very simple, coppery silk with narrow straps that flattered a small frame. Her only jewelry was the Morganstone ring, worn on a chain around her neck. The very plain silver chain brought out the shape of her collarbones and the curve of her throat. Not that many months ago, seeing Clary dressed up for a wedding would have conjured up in Simon a mix of feelings. Dark despair, she would never love him, and high excitement, or maybe she would, if he could get up the nerve to tell her how he felt. Now it just made him feel a little wistful.
Nice, echoed Clary. Is that it?
Sheesh.
She turned to Maya. What do you think? Maya had given up on the uncomfortable chairs and was sitting on the floor, her back against the wall that was decorated with tiaras and long gauzy veils. She had Simon's DS balanced on one of her knees, and seemed to be at least partly absorbed in playing Grand Theft Auto.
Don't ask me, she said. I hate dresses. I'd wear jeans to the wedding if I could. This was true. Simon rarely saw Maya out of jeans and t-shirts. In that way, she was the opposite of Isabel, who wore dresses and heels at even the most inappropriate times. Though since he'd once seen her dispatch a vermis demon with a stiletto heel of a boot, he was less inclined to worry about it. The shop bell tinkled, and Jocelyn came in, followed by Luke. Both were holding steaming cups of coffee, and Jocelyn was looking at Luke, her cheeks flushed and eyes shining. Simon remembered what Clary had said about them being disgustingly in love. He didn't find it disgusting himself, though that was probably because they weren't his parents. They both seemed so happy, and he thought it was actually rather nice. Jocelyn's eyes widened when she saw Clary.
Honey, you look gorgeous.
Yeah, you have to say that. You're my mother, Clary said, but she grinned anyway.
Hey, is that coffee black by any chance?
Yeah, consider it a sorry-we're-late gift, Luke said, handing her the cup. We got held up, some catering issue or the other.
He nodded towards Simon and Maya.
Hey, guys.
Maya inclined her head. Luke was the head of the local wolf pack, of which Maya was a member. Though he'd broken her of the habit of calling him master or sir, she'd remained respectful in his presence.
I brought you a message from the pack, she said, sitting down her game console. They have questions about the party at the Ironworks.
As Maya and Luke fell into conversation about the party the wolf pack was throwing in honor of the Alpha Wolf's marriage, the owner of the bridal shop, a tall woman who had been reading magazines behind the counter while the teenagers chatted, realized that the people who were actually going to pay for the dresses had just arrived and hurried forward to greet them.
I just got your dress back. It looks marvelous, she gushed,
taking Clary's mother by the arm and steering her toward the back of the store. Come and try it on. As Luke started after them, she pointed a threatening finger at him.
You stay here.
Luke, watching his fiancée disappear through a set of white swinging doors painted with wedding bells, looked puzzled. Mundanes think you're not supposed to see the bride in her wedding dress before the ceremony, Clary reminded him. It's bad luck. She probably thinks it's weird you came to the fitting.
But Jocelyn wanted my opinion.
Luke broke off and shook his head.
Ah, well, mundane customs are so peculiar.
He threw himself down in a chair and winced as one of the carved rosettes poked into his back.
Ouch. What about Shadowhunter weddings?
Maya inquired, curious.
Do they have their own customs?
They do, Luke said slowly. But this isn't going to be a classic Shadowhunter ceremony. Those specifically don't address any situation in which one of the participants is not a Shadowhunter.
Really?
Maya looked shocked.
I didn't know that.
Part of a Shadowhunter marriage ceremony involves tracing permanent runes on the bodies of the participants, said Luke.
His voice was calm, but his eyes looked sad. Runes of love and commitment. But, of course, non-Shadowhunters can't bear the angel's runes, so Jocelyn and I will be exchanging rings instead.
That sucks,
Maya pronounced. At that, Luke smiled.
Not really. Marrying Jocelyn is all I ever wanted, and I'm not that bothered about the particulars. Besides, things are changing. The new council members have made a lot of headway towards convincing the clave to tolerate this sort of...
Clary!
It was Jocelyn, calling from the back of the store.
Can you come here for a second?
Coming,
Clary called, bolting down the last of her coffee.
Uh-oh, sounds like a dress emergency.
Well, good luck with that. Maya got to her feet and dropped the DS back in Simon's lap before bending to kiss him on the cheek.
I have to go. I'm meeting some friends at the Hunter's Moon.
She smelled pleasantly of vanilla. Under that, as always, Simon could smell the salt scent of blood, mixed with a sharp, lemony tang that was peculiar to werewolves. Every downworlder's blood smelled different. Fairies smelled like dead flowers, warlocks like burnt matches, and other vampires like metal. Clary had once asked him what Shadowhunters smell like.
Sunlight,
he said.
See you later, baby.
Maya straightened up, ruffled Simon's hair once, and departed. As the door closed behind her, Clary fixed him with a piercing glare. You must work out your love life by next Saturday, she said. I mean it, Simon. If you don't tell them, I will. Luke looked bewildered.
Tell her what?
Clary shook her head at Simon. You're on thin ice, Lewis. With which pronouncement she flounced away, holding up her silk skirts as she went.
Simon was amused to note that underneath them she was wearing green sneakers.
Clearly, said Lynn, something is going on that I don't know about.
Simon looked over at him.
Sometimes I think that's the motto of my life.
Luke raised his eyebrows. Has something happened? Simon hesitated. He certainly couldn't tell Luke about his love life. Luke and Maya were in the same pack, and werewolf packs were more loyal than street gangs. It would put Luke in a very awkward position. It was true, though, that Luke was also a resource. As the leader of the Manhattan Wolf Pack, he had access to all sorts of information and was well-versed in downworlder politics.
Have you ever heard of a vampire named Camille?
Luke made a low whistling sound.
I know who she is. I'm surprised you do.
Well, she's the head of the New York vampire clan. I do know something about them,
Simon said a little stiffly.
I didn't realize you did. I thought you wanted to live like a human as much as you could.
There was no judgment in Luke's voice, only curiosity.
Now, by the time I took over the downtown pack from the previous pack leader, she had put Raphael in charge. I don't think anyone knew where she'd gone exactly, but she is something of a legend.
An extraordinarily old vampire, from everything I understand. Famously cruel and cunning. She could give the fair folk a run for their money.
Have you seen her?
Luke shook his head.
Don't think I have, no. Why the curiosity?
Raphael mentioned her,
Simon said vaguely. Luke's forehead creased.
You seen Raphael lately?
Before Simon could answer, the bell shop sounded again, and to Simon's surprise, Jace came in. Clary hadn't mentioned he was coming. In point of fact, he realized Clary hadn't mentioned Jace much lately at all. Jace looked from Luke to Simon. He looked as if he were mildly surprised to see Simon and Luke there, although it was hard to tell. Though Simon imagined that Jace ran the gamut of facial expressions when he was alone with Clary, his default one around other people was a fierce sort of blankness.
He looks, Simon once said to Isabel, like he's thinking about something deep and meaningful, but if you ask him what it is, he'll punch you in the face.
So don't ask him, Isabel had said, as if she thought Simon was being ridiculous. No one says you two need to be friends.
Is Clary here?
Jace asked, shutting the door behind him. He looked tired. There were shadows under his eyes, and he didn't seem to have bothered to put on a jacket despite the fact the autumn wind was brisk. Though cold could no longer affect Simon much, looking at Jace in just jeans and a thermal shirt made him feel chilly.
She's helping Jocelyn, explained Luke, but you're welcome to wait here with us.
Jace looked around uneasily at the walls hung with veils, fans, tiaras, and seed-pearl-encrusted trains.
Everything is so white.
Of course it's white, said Simon.
It's a wedding.
White for shadow hunters is the color of funerals, Luke explained. But for mundanes, Jace, it's the color of weddings. Brides wear white to symbolize their purity.
I thought Jocelyn said the dress wasn't white, Simon said.
Well, said Jace. I suppose that ship has sailed.
Luke choked on his coffee. Before he could say or do anything, Clary walked back into the room. Her hair was up now, in sparkling pins, with a few curls hanging loose.
I don't know, she was saying as she came closer to them. Karen got her hands on me and did my hair, but I'm not sure about the sparkles.
She broke off as she saw Jace. It was clear from her expression that she hadn't been expecting him either. Her lips parted in surprise, but she said nothing. Jace, in his turn, was staring at her, and for once in his life, Simon could read Jace's expression like a book. It was as if everything else in the world had fallen away for Jace but himself and Clary, and he was looking at her with an unconcealed yearning and desire that made Simon feel awkward, as if he had somehow walked in on a private moment. Jace cleared his throat.
You look beautiful.
Jace. Clary looked more puzzled than anything else.
Is everything all right? I thought you said you couldn't come because of the conclave meeting.
That's right, Luke said. I heard about the shadow hunter body in the park. Is there any news?
Jace shook his head, still looking at Clary.
No. He's not one of the New York conclave members. But beyond that, he hasn't been identified. Neither of the bodies have. The Silent Brothers are looking at them now.
That's good. The brothers will figure out who they are, said Luke.
Jace said nothing. He was still looking at Clary, and it was the oddest sort of look. Simon thought The sort of look you might give someone you loved but could never, ever have. He imagined Jace had felt like that about Clary once before, but now...